episode 410. This is Klaatu, your friendly host. In this episode, we're going to continue our coverage of all the different packages that get installed by default on Slack or Linux. It turns out there are lots of open source packages that get installed on a Linux system, and a lot of us don't really even realize it because we don't necessarily have the occasion to interact with them, or we don't interact with them directly. They get invoked by some other thing that we're doing, used by other applications. So we're looking at every single one that gets installed and exploring what they do. Now, if you're not running Slackware, that's okay. All of these applications are open source, so you can install them on non-Slackware Linux systems, or even non-Linux systems, usually, because, again, they're open source. So let's get started. We're in the D for development software series of Slackware. And the first one that we've got to cover this episode is Doxygen, D-O-X-Y-G-E-N. Doxygen is a documentation generator, which seems very exciting, and in fact it is. I will say that in real life, Doxygen has made my work at certain occasions, just depending on the job, but there have been several times I could cite in real life where Doxygen has just made things so easy for me. It's been a real joy to work with. Now, there's something important to know about Doxygen, and that is that when it says that it's a documentation generator, it is not talking about magical general user documentation that gets generated from your open source project. That would be amazing. I mean, it would probably put a lot of people out of jobs, but I mean, it would be nice to get automated documentation for users that was actually useful from some kind of script. That would be pretty neat. But we're not there yet, and Doxygen is very specifically generating documentation really meant for developers. Now, that's not to say Doxygen can't be useful as just a general documentation build tool, but I will say that its specialization, like the real reason that you would want to look at Doxygen, is because it can look at your code, at the source code in a project directory, and generate in either HTML, RTF, believe it or not, or LaTeX, documentation about the inputs, so in other words, the required arguments, the outputs, so the return values, the class names, the function names, the irrelevant variables, public and private, and all this other information. That, yes, you can glean all this information from reading the source code yourself. But of course, the advantage to documentation is that in open source, because there's an argument, I guess, I mean, I don't know if anyone's making the argument, but there is an argument that, well, open source is naturally documented. You get to see the source code. That's all the documentation you technically ever would need. It's just not very efficient all the time to just point people at source code and say, well, just read that over and you'll figure out how to, you know, write a new function or a new class or to use elements of our framework. Documentation brings all of that knowledge and summarizes it into one concentrated location, which is really, really useful. And that's why Doxygen has helped me in the past, because sometimes I'll be either documenting or maybe writing a plugin for something, like a Python. They'll have a Python API, and you'll be writing a Python plugin, but you don't know what a certain C function requires as its argument or something like that, or what kind of value it returns. And so you need that information, and you can either scrub through all of the source code, or you can just run Doxygen against the source, and you get all the information from that. So the cool thing is here that Doxygen often could help you as a person. It could help you even in cases when the project itself hasn't adopted Doxygen. I have run Doxygen on projects that aren't using Doxygen. It's just a local, I do it locally. I run Doxygen, create a Doxygen configuration file, run it, and end up with documentation that the open source project does not provide. So it's really, really useful. If I'm not making that clear, I want to make that very clear. It's really useful. Okay, so now let's look at how it does this. Well, actually, first, we'll look at how it does this. And the way that it does this is it works against, it parses source code, and therefore Doxygen, if you're going to use Doxygen, you must use it on a project that Doxygen understands, or on a project using a language that Doxygen understands. Doxygen supports C, C++, Objective-C, C#, PHP, Java, Python, something called IDL, which I actually don't know what that is. I've never looked into it. Corba, Microsoft, UNO, Open Office flavors. That's what it says about IDL. Also Fortran, VHDL, and to some extent D, as in Delta, D, the language D. And so if you're using any of those languages in a project, or if a project uses is written in those languages, then you can use Doxygen. So that's a pretty good sample set of popular languages. So there's a good chance that the thing that you want to document is supported by Doxygen with that list. As I said, you can use Doxygen to generate HTML or LaTeX or RTF, but you really shouldn't do RTF. It's a deprecated format. I don't know why they even bother going out to RTF. I'm assuming they're doing that because they don't know what else to go out to for Microsoft Word. But RTF is a horrible format. You should never use it. So I'm just going to say that it goes out to HTML and LaTeX. It also says that there is support for generating output in PostScript, hyperlinked PDF, compressed HTML, and Unix man pages. And the way that they say that there's support for that is it makes me think that what they're saying there is that with post-processing, you can easily get to those formats from the native HTML and LaTeX output, which makes sense to me because LaTeX certainly has a PDF engine, so that would take care of the PostScript and the PDF, I think. And yeah, so it makes sense. Okay, so let's look at how to get started. I guess one way to get started, I guess the easiest way to get started would be to create a sample project and do that, and run Doxygen against it. So the sample project, I mean, I could sit here and write a bunch of C code or C++ code that was just for examples, and I could do that. I'm not going to. Instead, I'm going to use an actual project that is active and is maintained. It's a Java project that I'm working on, and this is, I'll call it an example project. There's a folder here in the Java project. I'm building this in NetBeans, and so there is Apache NetBeans. And so there's a certain directory structure that is kind of encouraged / imposed. So in this case, all of my Java sources are in source / org / example / example. So that's the reverse DNS name done as a directory structure. Now I'm calling that out specifically because Doxygen by default parses, or rather searches, the current directory for your source code, which I feel is probably relatively rare, probably. I don't know. I mean, I guess not completely, but I don't know. I don't go into that many project directories and just find a bunch of C code and header files just right there in the parent, you know, in the top level directory. So for me, that feels a little bit unlikely. Okay, so we have a project directory. Anyway, we've got a project, we've got code squirreled away in a bunch of subdirectories, and that's a good start. So the first step is to auto-generate with Doxygen a configuration file. This isn't a big deal. This is just a big empty template file that Doxygen makes available to you really, really easily so that you can get started by filling out values and reading comments and such that already exist. I mean, the other way would be for you to go into Doxygen's documentation, find out what the required fields are, and fill everything out. But this makes it more of a, you know, you can kind of, it's a tour through the configuration file. And to generate this, it's just Doxygen, Doxygen-G, and then the name of the configuration file that you want to create. That is a name for the default configuration file. I have seen a lot of projects call their Doxygen configuration file Doxy file, capital DOXYFILE. So that's what I call mine, Doxyfile. And it takes a split second, and it tells you in the output to go edit this, and then to run Doxygen Doxyfile. So we need to edit it first. So I'm opening it up in Emacs. You can open it up in anything that you want, any text editor. And the first couple of values, most of these values are just kind of, you can leave them safely as their defaults, like the Doxyfile encoding, UTF-8, that works for me. Project name, I'll give that a project name. I'll say my example project. Project number, I'm going to leave that blank for now because it doesn't actually matter to me. Project underscore brief equals just a sample Doxygen documentation. Get rid of that A. Just some sample Doxygen documentation. Okay. I think that's it for that sort of the kind of the profile. Output underscore directory. This one's important. I think by default it goes to /tmp, which is okay, but not terribly convenient, really. I mean, I don't know about building my documentation to /tmp. So I'm going to make a new, I'm going to tell it that I want my documentation stored in a directory called docs. Now, that would be up to you, of course. It depends on how your build process works. Maybe you want it in, I don't know, share docs, or well, you'd probably just want it in docs, really, and set your prefixes with your AutoTools or CMake. But anyway, I'm gonna put it into docs, D-O-C-S. So that'll be a directory within my project directory where my documentation is placed. And I think the other thing that I want is the input. So if the documentation directory is the essentially the output, documentation directory is the output, we also need to define what our input is, or rather where our input is located. And that's the tricky thing. So by default, again, Doxygen looks in the current directory for all of your source files. But in my experience, most projects put it into at least a directory called source, SRC, or maybe, well, usually it's called source, really. So I'm going to tell it that my input equals source /org/example/example/, and that way it knows to look in that subdirectory for my Java, my .java files. And there's a bunch of other values that you could define for your input. I've never had a problem with this because I think I must use very common extensions for my source code, but if you have a bunch of, you know, a lot of things that are mixed in with each other, then you might need to tell it the value for input, for valid input files, such as *.cc, *.cpp, *.c++, and so on. And I don't need to do that, but obviously all of this stuff is just kind of in this file as comments and as empty values, and so you are able to read through and find the different specific requirements for your project as you may either know them in advance or as you may discover after running Doxygen. For instance, I think probably the very first time I ever ran Doxygen, I learned pretty quickly that the input value was particularly important because you'll run it and it seems to do some fancy stuff, and then you open it up and it's completely empty. There's no documentation. And the reason for that, of course, is that it didn't find any source code in your current directory, because your current directory is full of README files and author file, to-do file, and so on. So you have to tell it, oh yeah, look in source directory or whatever. Okay, so scroll through quite a ways again until you finally come upon a value, or a section rather, configuration options related to the HTML output. Now this should be defaulting to yes. Yeah, it says the default value is yes, so that should be already on when you look at it. You would want to make sure that that was on, and then you'd want to do a search probably, just to make this a little bit quicker, for generate underscore RTF and set that to no. That's the default value for that one as well, so that's probably safe. And then generate underscore, what's the other one? Latex. The default value there is yes, which is good, and I have nothing against latex. I'm going to set that to no for now because I happen to know that I don't actually need that all that much. But there you go. That's our configuration. So the big one to remember is the output, or the what is it, documentation underscore dir, or directory, or whatever it's called, and then the input. Those are the two, I think, that are probably most significant at first, because you need to know where it's going to put the stuff, the files, and it needs to know where to find the source code that you want it to parse and generate documentation for. Okay, now that that's done, I can run doxygen, and then, like I say, just point it to that doxy file. It doesn't take long for this to run, because I don't have that, there's not really that much source code. And now if I look in the docs directory, there's a new folder there called HTML. If I look in the folder for HTML, there's a bunch of files in there. There's HTML files and PNGs and JavaScripts and CSS and all kinds of stuff. But the one that makes sense to pay attention to initially is the index.html file. And so I'm going to go into Firefox here, and I'm going to open a file and navigate to my demo directory and open up this index.html file within my project. And there we go. It says my example project, just some sample DocsEngine docs documentation. Now granted, this little title page that it has automatically generated for me is not super impressive. There's not a whole lot here. I can modify some values in DocsEngine so that it ingests some kind of template or some kind of what would it be, boilerplate text, sort of an introductory stuff. But for me, I think that's okay. This is blank. I'll just leave it blank right now. Along the top there, there's the main page, and then there's a tab for classes. If I click on classes, there's a lot more data, and I see that it understands the structure of my files, and it knows that there are classes. There's app, there's create project, picture, save data, timeline. And if I go into the app class, for instance, then I can find a bunch of different functions that are contained within the app class. Or if I go into, let's see, the timeline here, there's pop timeline. The pop function requires a timeline value, so some kind of value for timeline, a value for file type dir underscore images. So that must mean that when using the pop function, you have to pass it both the timeline that you want to refer to and a directory filled with images. So you can kind of derive from this that the project must consist of a bunch of images, which are contained somewhere on the hard drive. So you kind of learn quite a lot, I think, about the structure of this project just by reading just kind of an overview from DocsEngine. It's really, really useful. There's, let's see, int get resume. So get resume requires, that's another function, and the return type is int. And it requires a file full of images, so that's useful to know. I can click on into each of these functions for even more information, and it gives me if there's any kind of documentation within the source code, like Java doc kind of documentation, then it uses those values here in DocsEngine. So in other words, I've got int timeline get resume with my required, it's telling me that there's a required argument of file dir underscore images. It says that the purpose of this function is get latest frame count. Now, it doesn't know this. This isn't DocsEngine being supernaturally clever and being able to sort of understand the meaning of this function. It just knows that because, in my case, Apache NetBeans prompted me to fill out the documentation comments, which are valid, like Java doc comments or whatever. DocsEngine is able to parse that because it has an awareness of that format, and it uses that in this documentation. So that's pretty great. It knows what it returns. It's the largest underscore int, which is the number assigned to the latest image. The parameters dir images, project directory containing images. So all of this stuff is taken from a well-documented source code base, which itself was sort of non-stop prompted by the IDE, because I'm sure that if it hadn't asked me for these values, I would have not known how to put those values in, I wouldn't have known what to say, whatever. So this is a great example of a bunch of different systems working really, really well together. And I think, in a way, I think it's a real argument, I think, for I guess open standards and collaboration among open source, because I mean this is, and I'm not saying that this stuff doesn't happen in non-open source. I'm just saying that it's very, very integrated, the way that these systems are working together, and it's really, really great to see within and without open source. I mean, this is brilliant. This is such a cool, I mean, so much has gone into making this beautiful documentation, and part of it is Doxygen, but part of it is just the fact that the IDE prompts to force the developer to encourage the developer to fill out the comments, and the fact that a standardized commenting format exists for Java code. I mean, and that exists for other things too. There's Python, I think, has like, I think Google has defined a very specific format for Python comments, and that can be used in a lot of different things. So, I mean, there's plenty of examples of this happening all over the place. I'm just saying this is really cool to see. This is a beautiful thing, because this could be a big mess. This could be Doxygen guessing that one comment at the top of the function is probably a description. But, I mean, would it know to describe the parameters? Would it know to describe the return value? I don't know. I mean, I guess we could try to make it guess at that, but, I mean, it's all very explicit and very well-defined, and it's just so cool and so, so useful. So I'm going to click on a different class here now. So here's a save data class. And save data is class, just kind of starting from the top, there's static public member functions, and so it tells you what the setup for this class has been. Static void init file dir images throws io exception, static void update file int count, static void save file dir images again, and so on. Static private functions, stuff that you're not going to be able to use from outside the class. Static final properties, prop equals new properties. Detailed description, author, clatu, member function documentation, static int, let's see, git count, file dir images, git latest frame count, parameters, dir images, project directory containing images, and so on. So lots and lots of useful information parsed and made beautiful for other people to be able to understand quickly. And like I say, this is very developer-focused. This is not the stuff that most users are going to want to see. And it is, I do remember very, very early on seeing some project saying that it's well-documented. And I remember going in and looking at the documentation and seeing this web page looking documentation thing of just literally just a laundry list of, not literally a laundry list, a laundry list of classes and functions. And I just remember thinking, that's not documentation. But I mean, from a user perspective, yes, that is not documentation. That's not useful. However, if you are someone looking to either document exactly what a project actually does, which I feel like in technical documentation happens a lot less than it ought to, then you can look at this. You can look at the source, the documentation of the source code. If you are looking to write a plugin for something that has some kind of plugin system, but you don't know what the class that you are targeting actually returns, what data type it provides at the end of the at the end of its main function, like what's it actually spitting out as an instance of that class. You can find that out. If you don't know what parameters you need to feed something, you can find that out, and so on. So this is really, really useful for a certain user base, either those, you know, really, really almost developer hobbyist users or actual developers. Like, this is exactly what they need, and this is just such a nice resource to have, if that's what you're looking for. Doxygen obviously isn't a substitute for really good user documentation. Like if you've developed an application, you want people to understand how to use it effectively, that should be documented by someone. And that would not document classes and functions, it would document buttons and interfaces and menus and so on. But Doxygen, for one audience, is nearly priceless. So that's how you used oxygen. That's really the extent of it. There's not a whole lot more to say, to be honest. I mean, there is more to say. There's, you know, it's a system. You can customize it a lot. You can add boilerplate stuff. You can change the theme, all that other stuff. But I don't feel like that's really I don't think that's worth going over here, because for that, you're going to want to explore on your own. But the basics of it is doxygen-g doxy file, and then edit that doxy file in your favorite text editor, point it to your input, provide a reasonable output directory for yourself and for your build system, and then run doxygen doxy file. And you can do that manually, or you can do that through a make file or whatever your build system is. Suddenly you've got great, great documentation. Let's go get some coffee. Come back and talk about GCC. Coffee has been obtained. It is very good today, and that means it's time for GCC talk. So GCC is the GNU C compiler. That's what that stands for. G++ is the C++ compiler. GCJ is a Java compiler. So there's a couple of variations to this. Let's really quick look at how this all gets broken down in the actual package listing. So if I do an ls on /var/log/packages/gc and then tab a bunch of times, I get gcc gfortran, gcc-g++, gcc-go, gcc-java, gcc-objective-c, and so on. So let's actually find out how many of those are in this package that we're talking about right now. Looks like there are a couple of fake outs here and a couple of things we've already talked about. So there's C89 and C99 and a command called just CPP. I'm going to do an ls-l on user bin C89 to discover that that is a... Okay, actually, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to do a file on user bin C89 to discover that that is actually a shell script. I imagine that if I looked at it, it would be some kind of invocation of GCC, and yes, it is. It's actually a very short file. It's about 6 lines. So it is a GCC-ANSI, ANSI-standard equals C89-standard equals ISO 9899:1990. So in other words, this is catching instances when a user is invoking GCC with specific options, and it is ensuring that some options are passed along with it. Same thing for C99, except its conditions are different. Now, it looks like CPP is not C++, CPP. It is a C preprocessor, and it says that the C preprocessor, often known as CPP, is a macro processor used automatically by GCC, or any C compiler, I guess, could use it. But in this case, we're sort of limiting our scope to GCC. So it's used by the C compiler, GCC, to transform your program before compilation. It is called a macro processor because it allows you to define macros, which are brief abbreviations for longer constructs. The C preprocessor is intended to be used only with C, C++, and Objective-C source code. In the past, it's been abused as a general text processor. It will choke on input which does not obey C's lexical rules. For example, apostrophes are interpreted as the beginning of character constants and cause errors. Also, you cannot rely on it preserving characteristics of the input which are not significant to C family languages. If a makefile is preprocessed, all the hard tabs will be removed and the makefile will no longer work. So what it's trying to say there is that this is very specific to its declared purpose, and that is to translate macros into something else, into valid C code. Now, as the man page just warned us, of course, it could theoretically work no matter what. You just feed it text, it will work. But it is warning you that you're not supposed to do that. It wouldn't be happy with you if you did that. It does work, though. Okay, so let's try one really quick. You can find predefined macros on gcc.gnu.org in the documentation. Look in online docs /cpp/common-predefined-macros with dashes between each common-predefined-macros.html. And that tells you the really, really common predefined macros. There's a pretty long page of them. And these are, I guess, they're macros. I guess I shouldn't try to work my way around defining a macro. A macro is a predefined action that you can create, someone creates, that then some application or processor interprets in a specific way. So here's a little example of how we could use one. Really basic example. I'm going to do emacs hello.c, classic demo application here, hash include space angle bracket standard io.h angle bracket. If by the end of the D series you don't know how to write a hello world application in C, then I guess I probably haven't done my job. Int space main parentheses curly brace printf parentheses. Now, in the past, we've done like quote hello world close quote close parentheses semicolon return 0 semicolon close curly brace. Today, we're going to use a macro. We're going to do printf parentheses underscore underscore version V-E-R-S-I-O-N underscore underscore close parentheses semicolon and then return 0 semicolon close curly brace, save it, and close it. So now we've got a little demo application here, which if I were to do a cat on, so cat hello.c, then I see what I just typed. That's expect. If I do tack hello.c, I see what I just typed, except in reverse. Again, expected. I'm just kind of demonstrating what a processor does to a text file, right? So if I do a sed dash e single quote s slash version or underscore underscore version underscore underscore slash hello world slash apostrophe and then feed it hello.c, then I see the file that I typed, except instead of underscore underscore version in those parentheses, I've got the string hello world, the strings hello world. So that's what a processor does. A preprocessor looks at a text file and then does some kind of magical thing. So CPP does the same basic task, except with a lot of predefined knowledge about, for instance, a macro, in this case, called underscore underscore version. And again, if you look at the online documentation at GNU, at gcc.gnu.org, you can find all of these macros already listed, or you know, listed in a row, and it defines them. So underscore underscore version underscore underscore says this macro expands to a string constant which describes the version of the compiler in use. You should not rely on its contents having any particular form, but it can be counted on to contain at least the release number. Okay, good to know. So if I run this hello world application, this hello.c through CPP, so CPP space hello.c, I get back I get a lot back, actually. I get quite a lot because it's doing C pre-processing. So you'll remember that at the top of the file, the actual hello.c file, I had a hash include standard io.h. And in my C preprocessor version of this, I have quite a lot more than that. I've got all of the things that is inherent in all of in a standard C application. So I've got things like user include standard C predef.h, user include standard io.h. That is what I included. User include features.h, user include syscdefs.h, and so on. So that goes on for a while. And then it has some type definitions, unsigned car, underscore, underscore u, underscore car, short int, underscore, underscore u, and so on. So it goes on for, a long time. Let's actually find out roughly 800 lines of text. And then at the very, very bottom here, I have the text that I consciously typed in, int main, curly brace, blah, 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 print f, wait a minute, instead of underscore, underscore, version, underscore, underscore, I've got quote, 5.5.0, close quote. And that's because that macro has been pre-processed, transformed, and changed in the output of my file. And I guess that's a segue into GCC, even though I don't know if GCC is exactly next in the list, technically. It is. Perfect. So that was CPP. We're done. Now, GCC, hello.c. Now remember, if I do a cat hello.c, I've still got that underscore underscore version in there, right? Because CPP, it did the transformation and printed that transformation to standard out. So it got swapped out, but it wasn't like saved into the file. Now GCC, if I do man GCC, we get this description. When you invoke GCC, it normally does pre-processing, compilation, assembly, and linking. We've covered assembly and linking in the AS and LD episode, so we don't have to cover that. We've just now covered pre-processing with CPP. So technically all there is to cover is compiling, and I mean that in itself isn't a whole lot to say about it, to be honest. I mean, there probably is a heck of a lot to say about it, but certainly nothing I'm qualified to say about it. So, as I've said before, I think programming today, we code in programming languages that are vaguely familiar to us with words like while and return and if, then, else, things like that. Whereas CPUs, the little circuit chips in our computers, the electrical switches in our computers, they don't know the terms while and else and if. They speak in literally in series of electrical pulses and ones and zeros. That's their language. So in order to get something into a quote unquote machine language, the code needs to be compiled. And what that means is difficult for me to really truly understand myself, because I, again, I've never written a compiler, and so I feel like it's difficult to truly understand what the process is when you haven't implemented it yourself. But if we take it on faith that there's some translation that needs to happen from human recognizable languages that are written with keys on keyboards that we can press rather than indescribable symbols, such as you might see if you do a cat on slash user bin CPP, for instance. Actually, I'm not going to do a cat on that. I'm just going to do a head. You see a bunch of nonsense. I mean, you see some stuff in there that you recognize. That's the stuff that you can generally pull out with the strings command, which we've talked about before. But as it is, all this gibberish that we see, by the way, if you do that and it screws up your terminal, just type in whether you can see it being echoed on your terminal or not, R-E-S-E-T, reset, and that'll kind of restore everything back to your terminal. It shouldn't mess anything up, but I don't know what terminal you're using, so that's looking at a binary executable, and that can be a little bit funky, can be a little bit puzzling. So that's more or less, like, that's the closest you and I will probably get. Well, this is the closest I'll probably get to machine language. So GCC is the thing that magically handles that translation. And as we've discussed previously, part of that is pre-processing to catch all those macros or any of the macros. Part of that is to compile and then assemble and then link to libraries that are required and so on. This is GCC itself. GCC and then some application. In this case, it's going to be hello.c. That worked. The default output of GCC is a.out. So if I do a dot slash a.out, then I get the string 5.5.0. Why am I seeing that? Well, as we've already described, CPP is the preprocessor, and GCC is part of the routine, the list of tasks that GCC does. It first preprocesses your code. So GCC triggered CPP to run on my source code, hello.c. It found underscore underscore version underscore underscore, replaced it with the string 5.5.0, close quote, and then it compiled that into I'm guessing, what is horribly confusing looking machine language. So if I do head a.out again, yep, that looks pretty puzzling to me. I can't understand that. So I guess that's machine language. And then it did all the assembly and then it did the linking. I can kind of confirm that to some degree with LDD a.out. Looks like it's linked to a bunch of, well, to a paltry number of very important libraries on my system. So I can trust that GCC has done exactly what it has advertised. Let's do an ls-lh of a.out. Let's get rid of that h, I forgot. It looks like it's 10,824 bytes, so roughly 11,000, or 11 kilobytes, we could say. And that's for a simple Hello World application. There you go. Now, we could also, if we wanted to, if you'll recall, there was a command that we covered in, I think it was binutils, I would think, called readelf. And we could do a dash dash symbols a.out, and we see that we have, it looks to me like about 77 hits against, you know, we have 77 symbols that are being that are referenced in this elf binary. What's an elf binary? Well, I'll do a file of a.out, and it tells me, sure enough, a.out is elf 64-bit LSB executable x86-64 version 1 dynamically linked interpreter lib64ld linux x blah 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 with debug info not stripped. Okay, so this is telling us that we have an elf binary, and you'll recall in previous episodes I've linked to, in the show notes, to a really good article series on what exactly elf binary meant, like what that actually means. And so if you never got a chance to go read that, you definitely should. It's a really good, interesting series. Some of it'll go over your head, probably, possibly, I don't know you. Some of it went over my head, and still it was a really interesting series to read, because some stuff I caught, and yeah, it does kind of shed a lot of light on how this stuff works. So go read that sometime. So that's an elf binary. It's not stripped, and this is something that, so stripping a binary means that you are able to go in and dissociate these symbols that are being exposed from the actual code that needs to be run. And the reason you might want to do that is personally for file size. So let's try compiling this again, this time with the symbols stripped. So in many scripts, they strip symbols out after compiling, because it is a step that you can take after the fact. But GCC lets you do it during compiling as well, if you have the presence of mind to do that. And the way that you do that is GCC-S for strip, hello.c, for example, and then -o, I'm going to call it hello ver, as in version, and then I'll do an ls-l on hello ver. Now it's 6,200 bytes, quite a lot different than 11,000. So that's 6.1 kilobytes versus 11 kilobytes. Again, we're doing this with a Hello World application, so it's we're not talking about huge binaries here. But of course, it scales up. If you have a bigger binary and you strip stuff from that, then you're likely to see greater savings. And again, that's the dash S option. And if you don't do it, or if you suspect that a make file hasn't stripped, then you can always do it after the fact. There is a command called strip, and then let's do strip a, well, I guess ls-l first, a.out, just to confirm that it's 10,824 bytes. Yeah, it is. And now I'll do strip a.out, and it's reduced to 6,200. And of course, we could also just do readelf-symbols, I think, a.out. Hey, I only have 7 instead of 77 returns, symbols reported. So that seems to have worked. So GCC-S and strip are basically the same, as far as I can tell. Another way to reduce file size, potentially, is optimization. Optimization is the -o option in GCC. It's the -capital O And it's very confusing, potentially, if you're not familiar with it, because it kind of looks like dash zero, but it is very importantly and significantly dash O for optimization, I assume. And, I mean, there are no long options. Well, there are long options, but not everything has a long option in GCC. So dash capital O, that's optimization. And you can invoke optimization at different levels. So dash O, or dash O1, does the sort of the bare minimum optimization. Dash O2 optimizes more. O3 does even more. And dash OS, as in Sierra, optimizes for size. So there are, and there are yet more variations at dash O fast, dash OG, lots of different optimizations. And I think that in a way sort of speaks to what exactly we mean by the term optimization, because optimization could mean everything's going to be faster and better, but it also could mean, like dash OG for optimizing for debugging, that actually might not be the case. It may not be faster and better, but you'll get a lot more feedback when you need to do when you're debugging the thing, which as a developer you might have a particular need for additional information at any given point. So optimization doesn't always just mean make my computer better, or, you know, make this application run on my computer better. It just means that it's leaning into one thing or another in a different way. By default, from what I understand, GCC has a goal of reducing the cost of compilation and making debugging work in a reasonable way, you know, so sort of finding a good middle ground. And I guess part of the problem with compiling is that it costs CPU, right? If you compile and you do a dash J 6 or 8 or however many cores you have, then your CPU is being utilized on all cores. You'll see the activity on CPUs go way up. Your computer may not be able to perform as well because now you're compiling with, you know, your CPU cycles are being occupied by translating code from one language into a machine language. So you can see that. I feel like in real life, a lot of us normal, quote-unquote normal computer users, we don't see that activity that often because we're not usually compiling all the time. But for a developer who might be building and rebuilding and rebuilding and rebuilding, that's a real cost. And so optimizing, sometimes that actually matters. And certain packages like WebKit, or maybe it's GTK WebKit, I forget, one of those two, or maybe both of them, are huge and take forever to compile. And literally, you need a certain amount of RAM on your system to even expect to be able to compile all of that. Heck, Chromium OS is that way. It requires a healthy amount of RAM and a really healthy amount of hard drive space. And you can actually fail a build because you'll run out of RAM if you're doing it on, you know, the wrong system, as it were, because it just runs out of RAM while it's compiling. It keeps storing stuff there, and there's no more there to store stuff. So anyway, that's optimizing options, I guess. But you can see those yourself. You can see what optimizing does by doing GCC dash capital Q dash dash help equals optimizers, and that'll give you a full list of all the options that are invoked potentially with optimization. And it shows you what are turned on by default and what are not, you know, what's enabled and what's disabled and so on. You can look at the documentation on gcc.gnu.org/online/gcc/optimize-options.html to get a breakdown for each, you know, for each kind of optimization available to you and which options are activated when you invoke those. Now, as a quick little demonstration, I'm just going to go into this Rose Garden code base that I have, and it's built on CMake. Rose Garden is a digital audio workstation. I kind of like it. I use it sometimes, and I happen to have its code base lying around, so I'm just arbitrarily using it as an example. It's based on CMake, so I'm going to first, in one terminal window, start that building. So I'll just do it CMake dot dot, and then make dash J 6, so that's building, and then I'm going to get another copy of it and do a CC make, And that didn't work because I'm in the wrong directory, I'm assuming. Yep, okay. So do a CC make, and then toggle on the advanced options, and go down to this option when building a release. I'm going to add GCC, I mean, GCC is already there, but GCC-O, let's do 3. See what happens with that, and configure that, and then quit, and then build that. Okay, so while that's building, I'll go back over here and look at what Rose Garden, without optimization, gave me. It's 23,474,112 bytes. So that's about 23 megabytes. And if I go into the one that was optimized and do an ls-l on Rose Garden, I see that it's 16,407,496 bytes. So that's about 16 megabytes. So just with the optimization, I was able to carve off 6 or 7 megabytes. That's pretty great. That's a pretty big savings, especially if you're a packaging service like if you are the Fedora packaging team and you are hosting binary packages of Rose Garden for all of your users to download and potentially download and use. That could be quite a lot of savings for storage and for bandwidth and so on, and for your user bandwidth. That's kind of nice as well. And this is all under the assumption that there are certain things that are just safe to turn off or to either enable or disable. And what exactly those are, you can kind of see from looking at the options that are enabled under optimization. And I mean, there are a lot of them, and I guess this is a good time to just talk about just how many options there are in GCC and why I'm not going to ever get through all of them. It would probably take a year to go through all the options in GCC. There are options for the languages themselves, language options like -ANSI, -standard, those are the two exciting ones there. There are the C++ ones, there are Objective-C and Objective-C++ language options. There are language-independent options like message length and diagnostic show location, diagnostic color, diagnostic show option, and so on. There are warning options, which usually start with a -W, so sometimes you'll see a warning as you're compiling something, -W pedantic, or -W fatal errors, or -W whatever, and those are warnings. Those aren't fatal, those are warnings. I don't know actually what -W fatal errors is. I'd have to look at that one. That does sound pretty serious, I'll have to admit. But generally speaking, the warnings are warnings. So, here's one that, yeah, wno-format-extra-args, wno-free-non-heap-objects. I've seen that kind of warning a lot, where it's, because you look at it and you think, what's a wno? Well, it's a -w, and then the word no, div by zero, or whatever it's warning you about. And then there are debugging options, so those might be -f, disable IPA pass name, -f, disable whatever. So there's optimization options, there's preprocessor options, there's assembler options, there's linker options, there's directory options, and so on. And that's not even all of them. There's GNU Linux options, there's H8/300, DEC Alpha, IA64, LM32, MCore, MEP, MicroBlaze. I mean, it's just a list, just keeps going and going and going. So that's just something to be aware of. It is potentially a very powerful application, but you could get lost in here pretty easily. But a lot of these, I feel, are so specific to certain requirements that you're likely to discover them on an as-needed basis. And I would think that would be a pretty common way of discovering these, is just kind of think, oh, I have this problem that I have to solve. How do I solve it? And then you discover, oh, I discover it through this mechanism. I solve it with this option, whatever. So I'm trying to get some of the basics, really. Some of the really important ones, I guess, or maybe not so important. I mean, it's arguable that a lot of these aren't important because a lot of these are going to be handled by your make file. And so you're not going to potentially be interacting with these yourself necessarily. You might be interacting with these through AutoTools or CMake, which are going to invoke all of the sort of obvious options for you. So there is that argument, and I think it's a pretty good argument. I think for many of us, that isn't that necessarily that big of a deal. So we've talked a little bit about the dash O options. I daren't go into the dash F options, but I did mention them because you could go into the man page and look. Or the info page, and look at the different options, dash F, obj C, dash ABI, dash version, for instance. So let's say you are writing Objective-C code. Don't know why you would be, but people do. And you realize that you need to specify a certain ABI version. Well, now you know how to do that. And so again, that's kind of how you would, I would feel that you would probably compile your code, experience the error, and then look up either in the info page or online how to fix that error. And it would all trace back to, well, look up this option, figure out what you need to tell it, and then you'll be good to go. All right. So, yeah, let's talk about really quickly the dash L and the dash I options, because those are actually, I could see people using those before using many of the advanced dash F options and dash G options and dash M options and so on. So the dash L option is your gateway to pointing GCC to a specific library file that your code depends upon that for whatever reason isn't in an obvious place. It's not some place where GCC would know to look for it. Dash I is, this is dash capital I or dash capital L. So dash capital L is for library, dash I is for include files. So those would be things like your header files. If they're not in a normal expected place, and again, dot slash configure ought to discover this stuff for you, and it ought to warn you when they're not found, and maybe as a result, you do need to invoke GCC with a dash capital I or a dash capital L, but you do that, and you can point them to a specific location. So you could do something like GCC dash capital I slash user slash include. And that drives me crazy because from what I understand, you're not supposed to put a space between the dash I and then the location. So it always kills me because then you're trying to tab complete, but Bash doesn't recognize the completion because it can't figure out why your path starts with a dash I. Anyway, maybe I need to explore that more. Maybe it's simpler than I realized to get around that. So I'm going to do GCC dash capital I user include, for instance, hello.c, and then, of course, I have an a.out that works as expected because, well, obviously it does because it's a functioning application. So that's dash capital I and dash capital L, and I could come up with a more complex example where I write a library and then try to compile something with that library without having a location for that library, but I'm not going to bother doing that because that seems like a lot of work. You now know that dash capital I and dash capital L are things that are available to you. And wow, I'm running out of time. So, I mean, hopefully this talk about GCC has demonstrated sort of the flexibility of GCC because it has a lot of options, and also the kind of the interdependence of GCC on other components of your system, whether it's a library or an included file, or whether it's a macro, or whether it's an assembler program or a linker program, whatever it is, GCC kind of works with a bunch of other things and pulls in code or pulls in binaries to kind of compile your code as it needs to compile in order to get run correctly on your system. And you can kind of see that. I mean, you can see it break down. You know, we've done that already, right? I mean, if we do a GCC dash capital E, I think it is, we could do hello.c, and that's just running. That's, you'll get the pre-processed, the processor code, the processor output from CPP, because the dash E says stop after pre-processing. And we did the same thing, if you'll recall. We stopped after we stopped after assembling, and then we did the linking manually or something in a previous episode. So GCC has a little bit of flexibility there, and And you can expose that flexibility by making it stop at certain points. And you can break it too. I mean, we could do, for instance, if I copy hello, or I could even just cat hello.c into a file called hello.i. The extension matters to GCC. So if I say GCC hello.i, it errors out. It can't continue. It says there's a problem. There's a stray hash in the program, right at the beginning of the program. Hash include. Doesn't know what to do with that. And then it has another error here. It says expected some number of tokens before this other token, and it's finding an error with the angle bracket. It doesn't know what to do that with that, because none of this makes sense to it, because the dash, or the dot I, rather, hello dot I, tells GCC, and you can see this in the info page, it says that if you name a file with .i, a C file ending in .i tells GCC not to pre-process that file, whereas the .c identifies a file that must be pre-processed. .ii is C++ code that should not be processed. .mi is an Objective-C file that should not be, or must not be, pre-processed, and so on. So you can kind of mess around with GCC as much as you need to, but I think it's safe, and I'm sure someone's going to email me justifiably and tell me that this is not safe to say, but I feel like it's safe to say that most of us, some of us, okay, that there, I've revised it, some of us, are not going to really need a lot of the options in GCC. That for many of us, we're either going to be interacting with GCC through makefiles, or CMake, or whatever. Well, yeah, so AutoTools or CMake, which use some kind of makefile. Or we're going to be interacting with it just as GCC, point it to a file, and let it compile. Maybe point it to an include folder, maybe point it to a library, but sort of like, I don't know, you're not going to really go crazy with all these options yourself, because I don't think that's how normally people do write their GCC commands. I think they do let a build file generator manage a lot of those options for them, or they let GCC manage it for them. You know, I've never written out all the options for optimizing -03 or -02, whatever, but I've definitely used -02 and -03, that's for sure. So, yes, there's a lot there, but I don't feel like it's all necessarily everyday user-facing, or even everyday developer-facing. Someone can email me and tell me I'm wrong. I'm happy to hear that as well, because, you know, I certainly live in my little bubble of sort of what I do on a computer, and it could be quite different for someone else. Maybe someone else has all of these options memorized, I don't know. But I do feel like it's more or less safe to just kind of fall back on saying, okay, well, I'm going to let my makefile handle this for me. I will talk about one aspect of GCC before we go that you don't always hear about, and that is about maybe some of the security options. And this is an interesting one, because it's really easy to use. We don't always use it, and I guess it's an ongoing conversation as to whether or not this should be used all the time. I know Fedora has a certain number of things that they compile with something called PIE, which is Position Independent Executable. The idea here is that a binary executable and its dependencies get loaded into random places into memory, which reduces the opportunity, or the reliability, rather, of a return-oriented programming attack to be made against a computer, because when such a thing is looking for certain data in certain locations, it can now no longer rely on that data being in those locations. Of course, I don't know about the sort of like, okay, if the attack is automated when something is launched, I mean, could you just continue to attack every time it's launched and just hope that at one point you hit the lottery and you've got the correct locations? I don't know the probability of that. I don't know enough about it. But I do know that position-independent executables are a thing. It is something that you can use in GCC, and whether it's worth it or not is, I guess, maybe technically up to you, but you can try it. So it's GCC-PIE for position-independent code, -FPIE. Those are the two options to sort of enable this. And then what directory am I in? I'm not in my demo directory. Okay, here we go. And then hello.c, and we'll do a dash o of hello pi. Let's do that. And actually, we could also strip it. I'm going to add the dash s option there. So now I've got a hello pi that is presumably smaller than my first one, although I'll never know for sure, I guess. Dot slash hello pi should just echo that same old version string, and it does. So every time I'm running it, it's pretty much acting exactly the same from my perspective. But on the back end, I know, or I trust, that the components that are required to run that thing are getting loaded into different locations in my in memory. So that's PIE. You can tell a PIE executable from a standard executable, because when you do file hello pi, for instance, you get that ELF 64-bit LSB pi executable, and so on. Whereas if I did that on just like a.out, of course I get 64-bit LSB executable, no pi. So that's something that exists. It's something that you could use. You could try it out, see if it works. Like I say, there still seems to be some debate going on whether or not that's really something that's worth doing, and I guess there might be a performance hit, maybe, I'm not really sure. So it's kind of interesting, though. And yeah, I mean, there are a lot of sort of security-minded things that both readelf and GCC kind of interact with, but since I'm not an expert, I'm not going to start advising people on the best practices for compiling and what to leave in, what to leave out, and how to turn off executable parts of memory and weird things like that. So, but it is a fascinating study if you go down that path. There are lots of different options that you can enable and disable to you know, alter the way that your executable sort of works at a very, very low level. I think that's everything I've got about GCC. Like I say, it's a huge application, lots of options. There's no way that any podcast could possibly do it justice in one or five episodes. It would just be something that it would just go on and on. And unfortunately, I'm not qualified for that. It sounds like a great app. It sounds like a great podcast, and I think someone could do that show, and I think it would be pretty darned interesting to hear. And I know I'm running out of time, so really quickly, I just want to cover gcov so that we don't have to go back into this package next time. Gcov is for code coverage. And the invocation of this requires a little bit of setup, because you need to generate reports, essentially. So this is a little bit like the application that I've forgotten about now. G something where it was looking at gGraph or something like that. I don't know. Anyway, this is gcov. So you don't run it immediately. First, I'm going to put all of my source files here, hello C, into a dedicated project directory, because it's going to generate a bunch of other stuff. Might as well keep everything together. So the first thing that you want to do is gcc dash dash coverage, and then hello.c dash c. This generates, actually, let me see what this generates. Yeah, let me get rid of all the cruft that I have in here. So gcc coverage, hello c dash c. This generates the gcno file, which is a coverage. It's dash f test coverage is what that has run with, essentially. After that, we can run gcc. Wait, didn't that also? Yeah, it also generated the object file hello.o, which is kind of important. Now we can do a gcc dash dash coverage again. hello.o. So now we're running against the object file, which creates the a.out file that we can actually run. That's our binary. That's the binary executable. And that returns, of course, because I'm still using that macro, underscore underscore version underscore underscore, it returns 5.5.0. So that's expected in this case. So next we can run the actual gcov command. And first I'll just run it without anything. Shows a bunch of different options. So I'm going to do gcov on hello.c dash dash demangled dash names. I think that's all I'm going to put there. There's a couple of different choices, but I think that's really the only one that's useful right now. Actually, you know what? Dash dash function dash summaries. That's a good one. Okay, and it tells me that it's executed 100% of 3 lines of code, and it's creating a file called hello.c.gcov. And that's kind of the report that really matters. So if you do a less on hello.c.gcov, you get, in my case, a very brief little report of exactly what my program contains. And under normal circumstances, if I had a better example here, it would tell me things like how many times a function gets called, which is pretty useful if you think about, you know, like what your code is actually doing when it gets run. How many times does that function get called? Is something that should only be getting called once getting called like 20 times because you call it in a loop that you didn't mean to call it in or something, or you know, something's pinging, something's invoking a function that then invokes your other function that doesn't need to be invoked. How many times it returns a value, and what percentage of the function's blocks have been executed. All kinds of information about just kind of like what your code is doing. And I gotta say, even if you don't exactly understand what the significance of everything, it's not a bad thing to look at from time to time, because it does at least give you a different angle from which to view your code. And that can be rather revealing. And I know that for me, with coding, a lot of times I do start to lose track, you know, just because the way that you are coming up with ideas as you're typing them down, you think, okay, well, I need to have this data in order for this process to work. And then later you realize that, well, actually you don't need that data anymore because you've written that out of this process and it's become its own dedicated function that you can call anytime that you want. And then you start to question, well, okay, so if I don't need that, then why am I calling it at all here? Is that still useful, or can I just drop that as well? And you just start to lose sight of what exactly in your code you're actually invoking. And this is really useful to get an idea of what is getting invoked, what is getting run, how much of it is getting run through a test launch. You know, by the books, just reading the source code, what exactly is happening. And this gives you an interesting take on that. So, yeah, I just feel like usually as developers, especially hobbyist developers, we have kind of, one might have two ways of looking at code. You have the way that you're looking at your code when you're typing it, you know, in your IDE or your text editor or whatever it is that you're using. And then you have it when it's running. As you start to develop your skills a little bit more, maybe you start to get comfortable with a debugger. And so that's another way to look at your code. Now you've got three ways. You've got the raw code, the compiled code, or the running code. If it's not compiled exactly, maybe it's interpreted, but still somewhere it's gotten compiled. But you know what I mean. So it's running code. And then you've got the debug output that maybe you're getting from GDB or something like that. And then now with this, with gcov, you've got yet a fourth way to look at it. You've got this kind of regimented kind of analysis of what your code is doing, and that might reveal something to you so that you can then optimize it in some unique way. I think that's truly everything. Way over time, I think. That's okay. We've gotten through GCC. It was a big one. There's obviously a lot more to talk about with GCC, but I think this gives you kind of an idea of everything that it does. And it's probably worth mentioning because I keep saying I'm out of time, so why not just keep talking? But it is worth mentioning that GCC, in a way, I think, and I can't back this up with experience, but I feel like GCC, in a way, had the functionally the impact of, for instance, the Linux kernel. And by that I mean, like, if you think of yourself maybe before and after the Linux kernel, I mean, whether it's when the Linux kernel was actually created or when you knew it was a thing, it was very sort of transformative maybe. I mean, I know it was that for me. Like, after I discovered Linux, that was a huge deal. It changed the way that I saw computers, changed the way that I saw the world. It just made it such a huge impact. And I think for its time, GCC probably was in many ways that for a lot of people. And I know that there's an argument that, well, even without this you know, watershed moment, this big turning point in history, we would have gotten to the same place by some other avenue. And I think that's a valid argument. I think we could say the same thing about the Linux kernel. If it hadn't been the Linux kernel, it would have been something else, right? It would have been BSD that we would have all discovered, and we'd have gone down that path. Or it would have been Minix that we grabbed and forced into everyday use, or something. Something would have happened. Haiku. Who knows what it would have been? We would have gotten here in the end, probably, arguably. But I think that GCC, in the same way, it kind of had that same impact in the world. Because at that time, you know, in the mid-80s or early 80s or whatever, I don't believe that everyone would have had access to a C compiler. That's just not something everyone really should have had if you look back at what was being provided to people. And I think that's a big deal. GCC made a big splash, and it impacted a lot of both lives and processes. And I don't think one should underestimate that. I mean, it doesn't mean anything about GCC. It's not like a holy relic or anything. I'm just saying GCC was a big deal. It made a big impact. It changed a lot of lives. It changed a lot of technology. And in some ways, it's easy to sort of look past that and forget it, because now we just take it for granted. It's just GCC. It's the thing that you install when you want to compile software on Slackware. It's just a thing that you have anyway. But when it was developed, I mean, it was a really, really big deal. And for the longest of times, I mean, it was kind of the only deal. I mean, that was the one. That was the compiler. I mean, now we have LLVM or CLang or Clang or whatever however we refer to it. And it seems to be really nice, and I've used it a couple of times, and I've quite liked some of its features, actually. And it caught some errors that GCC didn't catch, and that, you know, it's a different thing. It's an option, and it's great that that exists now. But I just kind of want to end this on sort of just a recognition of how big a deal GCC was for the development of open source free software computing. Like, it was a really, really big deal. And I think one could argue, and there are counter arguments, but one could argue that without GCC, there just wouldn't be free software. There wouldn't be open source. There probably wouldn't be Linux. I mean, I think that's an arguable thing that you could say. Again, counter arguments, I'm sure. I'm sure there are other ways that it could have happened. People could have just compiled with proprietary compilers, but then would you have had as many people contributing, because they wouldn't have all had access to proprietary compilers? You know, it's all a big what if and a big alternate history sort of exercise in ultimately what is futility. GCC was a big deal. It was the Linux kernel of its time. Not literally, obviously, it's not a kernel at all. It's not related to Linux in any way, but in its time, it was that kind of impact on the computing world and on the development world. Then certainly if you're running Slackware, you're using it all the time. If you're using slackbuilds.org, that's such a lot of power to have just at your fingertips without really, really even thinking about it. And the power is, of course, and I go back to this fairly regularly, I guess, but the power is that source code is its own packaging format. Because of GCC, we can trade programs, we can trade applications with one another really easily by just giving each other text files, and then GCC magically transforms it into very, very useful applications. It's astonishing if you really, really think about it. So GCC is a huge feature in terms of me having paid $50 or whatever I pay for Slackware, and I get GCC just casually as a part of that package, as part of the package deal. It's kind of staggering. So I just want to kind of convey the importance and significance of a compiler, a free, $0, fully, all of the liberties that you need bundled along with it, C compiler. It's a really, really, really powerful tool. Even though we may not understand all of its options, we may not even use it all that often ourselves, but it is a truly, truly powerful force that drives open source. So enjoy it. Thanks for listening to the show. I will talk to you next week. Listening to the GNU World Order Ogcast. This has been Klaatu. You can reach me on IRC. I'm on the Freenode network usually in channels such as Ogcast Planet, Slacker Media, Slackware, a couple of others. My nick on IRC is NotKlaatu. You can also reach me lately on Mastodon. My username there is @klaatu@mastodon.xyz. Of course, you can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. That's klaatu@member.fsf, as in Free Software Foundation.org. And of course, you can visit my various websites, GNUWorldOrder.info and SlackerMedia.info. I will see you next time.
Mind is troubled, but you are with your friends now, and there is nothing more to worry about.